Planning Commission meeting for Tuesday, July 19th, 2011. First order of business is the Pledge of Allegiance. Roll call, please.
Casper?
Here.
Dearborn?
Here.
Bryson?
Here.
Knudsen? Shannon?
Here.
Ward?
Here.
Emery?
Here. Do we have agenda changes, Deborah?
No, we do not.
Okay. Commissioners, you have been sent electronically the minutes of the July 5th meeting. Any additions, corrections, changes? If not, a motion for approval?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Next order of business is public comments on non-agenda items and agenda items 6, 7, and 8. We have no public this evening, so I won't go into the spiel on that. We have no final orders, resolutions, or written communication, nor any public hearings or old business. So that brings us to new business, and we have work sessions, four work sessions on proposed ordinance amendments. This is group two. First group was discussed at the July 15th meeting. So at this point, we'll turn it over to Deborah.
Thank you. We're going to do a series of amendment proposals this evening, and we've got three amendment proposals, and then we also have a rezoning that we're going to be talking with you about.
And all these will be, I mean, these are for information only and will be presented in public hearing middle of August. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Just so the listening public will know.
That's right. Okay, the first amendment is actually two parts. It is to the height ordinance, which we just revised not that long ago, but we noticed that we had two things that we wanted you to consider. The first part is about the definition in the Nell Scott part of our ordinance. Nell Scott has a special ordinance section that has, it's broken down into a Nell Scott beach mixed use, Nell Scott cottage residential. At any rate, somehow we ended up with a definition in there that is unique and different than the definition of height anywhere else in town. In the rest of the ordinance, we have height defined as from the approved grade, and that's something we just changed recently, to the peak of the roof. In the Nell Scott district, it is to the midpoint of the roof. And this causes some confusion, and it also allows anybody building in Nell Scott an extra a few feet, perhaps, depending on the peak of their roof. So we wanted you to consider amending the ordinance to delete that definition in Nell Scott in favor of the height ordinance and definition the way it is in the rest of the community. So I have on the PowerPoint here just a rough sketch of the difference between the roof midpoint and the roof peak. That's a fairly simple, straightforward amendment, but if you have any... Oops, that's okay, that's the next part. So if you have any comments about that, please feel free to let me know.
It's a good idea.
Okay. Anyone else?
This happened to come up because there was some building that required it to be looked at. The houses, when we made the zoning changes, they were to be at the peak, and the peaks were 35 feet. Then.
Okay. Well, Kate actually got a question about this. Someone had observed in our ordinance that there was a different definition in Nell Scott. Isn't that correct?
Right. There was a
an architect designing a new house in Nelscott and inquired about the definition of height in Nelscott, which brought it to our attention. And we really feel, in looking at the history of the Nelscott Plan District from 2008, that it was an oversight and was intended to be taken out, just as it was taken out when you did the Ocean Lake District. But for whatever reason, it didn't get deleted in Nelscott.
So I guess no building has been really attempted or changed since the first zoning passed. Is that why probably it popped up?
I mean, as I know,
yeah.
I think for the most part, we probably haven't seen a lot of new construction in the Nelscott Plan District area.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Anybody else? Okay. Thanks, Hugh.
All right. The part two of the height ordinance is something that was brought to our attention. A building owner who has property in the floodplain suggested that maybe we could take a look at giving owners in the floodplain a sort of a break or a little bonus, because when we adopted the 2009 flood maps from FEMA, some people were in the floodplain who weren't in before, or they were further in. And maybe you recall that if you are in the floodplain or in the VE zone, AE or VE, that FEMA and the National Flood Insurance Program require that buildings be elevated to 1 foot above what they call the base flood elevation. The base flood elevation is basically where they would expect flooding to occur in a 100-year storm, a 1% chance storm. But as we know, those do occur. We don't wait 100 years necessarily to see one of those storms. So at any rate, what this does, and I'll come back to this, but what this does is I've shown a house on the right here that's in the floodplain, and I am pointing with a red arrow to the peak of the roof if this would be 35 feet in height. Then down here at the bottom in the green box, I'm highlighting the BFE, or base flood elevation, plus one. That's what our ordinance says. You have to have the base flood elevation plus an extra foot to make sure you stay dry. This requires then that the structure itself cannot be 35 feet from the approved grade if it actually has to meet this BFE plus one, which may be several feet in some cases.
Well, it may be more than that. I mean, on a little road trip up the Siletz River, you see some of those FEMA houses that are elevated 8, 10, 12 feet in the air. So I guess I would hate to see somebody be able to, you know, start at 8, 10, or 12 feet as a baseline and then go 35 feet on top of that. It probably wouldn't mm-hmm. happen, but somebody's going to try it because they've got a view. So I think somewhere in the definition you have to find some ground. I mean, the flood zones that you're talking about changing this in that, what is that elevation?
Well, it varies around town. Uh-huh. I've got some examples here. So anyway, okay, let me just do this. Okay, so we have what we'd be doing is bumping it up by the same distance as it would have to be elevated off the ground. Here's an example.
How is that determined? I mean, if somebody buys a lot and they're going to build, who makes that decision of what it has to be? Who's responsible for doing that?
Well, the FEMA has already provided us with base flood elevations.
So you have that knowledge.
On their maps, we know, and in this case, I'm showing you this one where the BFE is 14 feet. Our ordinance says then that it has to be 14 plus 1, 15 feet. And that is the the elevation of the first floor. So we actually require a certificate of elevation, and it requires a surveyor to go out and shoot the elevation at first floor and then also Well, and then, and they also do a benchmark before the building gets started. So our ordinance says a BFE plus one for the first floor. In this case, you can see I've got topographic lines from our LIDAR, so they're very accurate. And this says this building, for instance, is at 13 feet. So if someone was going to build on this lot, if the house wasn't there, or if there was a substantial improvement to this house, they would have to elevate to 15 feet for their first floor and then build up from there. And that's the question, and we're not really advocating this that you go with this amendment, but it's for your consideration. Do you want to allow property owners who find themselves in this situation to have 35 feet plus the elevation, required elevation?
That if they're just going up 1 or 2 feet above grade of their property to hit that benchmark, then I wouldn't have a big problem with it. But I think there has to be, if they have to go up 8 feet, I think possibly tracked 8 feet from the overall building height.
Mm-hmm.
I like I say, I mean, the odds of it happening are probably pretty slim. A house that's 35 on feet on top of that, and it's going to look pretty hokey.
Tall. Pretty tall.
Potential of a ocean view or a river view or mm-hmm. but he's gonna push it to the limit and problem. So I think if you're going to give, you know, I can see making him come up to the 15 feet there, but I think we probably have to
have a cap.
In okay. In some situations, you might find yourself where a building owner cannot quite get a third story, for instance. You know, if you figure stories are about 10 feet or 9 feet, 8 or 9 feet plus 1 foot in between the floors. If you're trying to do three stories, you might be pushing that 30 plus the pitch on the roof. And that's where they would run into trouble if they had to elevate to start with.
Home with a 12-12 pitch in an attic. I mean, it's going to be
mm-hmm.
be up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hate to just carte blanche credit for the 2 feet they have to.
Yes.
What is the most?
I didn't include all the ones that you have in your packet, but this one is at the base flood elevation is 17, so the required elevation would be 18. Yeah, this is at 50.
Got to go up 3 feet in that case.
They might have to go up 3 feet, right.
Well, what about an area where the base elevation is?
I have not run across an example of a building lot where somebody's doing that, but it's certainly conceivable. Most of the ones that I see are within a few feet. An alternative, I think, to actually changing the ordinance might be to consider these as variances. If someone came and said, this is a hardship because I'm in this floodplain. And then, but, you know, I also have to think about now how would I review that and consider that in terms of our criteria. Would that be a hardship in your estimation, or would it make deprive them of a property right?
Well, they have the right to build on it.
They have the right to build. Do they have a right to a third floor?
They have to build.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Got to go down. You know, I mean, it's just
I
all of a sudden I'm gonna, you're going to see a house that's 55 feet off the ground.
I mean, conceivable. Right.
The potential is.
Right. And you'll notice in the little sketch I did, I've got the other person who's east presumably, maybe, of or upland, and whose view will be affected by, conceivably, by that extra 3 or 4 feet or more.
Maybe there could be some verbiage in there that said if that the required raise or in elevation of that floor, if it exceeds 3 feet from, you know, the original ground level or something like mm-hmm. that, then there is like for every foot above that, they have to take 6 inches off the height of the house or something, so you don't end up with it could be a foot for foot, you know, but maybe you could just give them some credit. It's just a conversation. It's all it is.
Are you thinking that a variance, that you would not like to see these as variances, or is that a possibility?
It's a possibility, but if we can get by without having to do every one of these as a variance,
would be hard to judge third story as a
whole. Yeah, that would be my concern. Would be that. Mm-hmm. You know, if
you're building this house, design something else.
Right, and variance sounds great, but then when I think about the criteria that we have, mm-hmm. I don't know that I would grant a variance for that.
Right.
I mean, that would be
right.
You know, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's my problem too.
Your second story, you know, that's
mm-hmm.
rough, but you know. So, I mean, what if it were, you know, whatever it is you imagine the most it would be? I mean, you're saying something, you know, like 3 to 5 feet. You know, what if you had that, and then beyond that, if they felt that it was enough of a hardship. Then they could do a variance. Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Sure. Certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever it is in your mind that you know that you're thinking, you know, gosh, you know, I mean, I suppose theoretically it could go up 15 feet more, but you know, I don't imagine it would go more than 3. Well, then great. Then put that 3 in there, and then if it's beyond that, then you know they can bring it before the commission.
I'll see if I can figure out what would be the most that someone would have to elevate before our public hearing. See if I can find some numbers for you.
Because in that case, there, I mean, that going to start blocking the view, like you pointed out, of the mm-hmm. people behind them, and they have a right. They bought that lot thinking, well, this guy can only go 35 feet. Now he's at 47.
Right.
I mean, I'm exaggerating. I do that on purpose just to make a
right.
point.
And make a good point, though. And it'll be 10
right.
years down the road, and the commission that's hearing it will be going, what are those commissioners thinking?
Right, right.
Mental picture of somebody coming in saying, I know it's only 3 feet, but I want 8 feet just to be sure. And 3 stories on top of that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, we'll give that some more thought, and...
Deborah, what too if the base level should change? Suppose the
and they do change.
Okay, so
we expect new maps in the next year or two.
Okay.
Again.
Mm-hmm. That might be different.
They might be, yeah. Those BFEs might be bigger.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So can you take into consideration what that might be in the and in your ordinance?
Well, the way we have it worded is it's the BFE plus one, so if the BFE changes, we're still adding 1 foot to it. But yes, it underestimates maybe what the effect would be in terms of the overall height. It doesn't change that much, but it's possible. All right, so we've got the hearing set for the first meeting in August. And so, isn't that correct, Kate?
Oh, all of the ones we're talking about tonight are the second meeting
in
August.
That's right. Okay, second.
Which is the 16th.
16th. So we will do some more work on it and see if we can come up with something. It could be that we can think of some conditions or something that you know, if these things are conditions are met, type of wording. But I'm not sure what that would be at this point, so we'll have to work on that one.
Right.
No, it's all right, because we, as I said, we're really not advocating for this amendment. We're throwing it out there. Right. The next amendment is Clear Vision. And clear vision is the area that we have at corners of where two streets intersect or where a driveway intersects with a street that are to be maintained free of obstructions between 2.5 feet and 8 feet so that a driver in a car can see if another car is coming or can see a pedestrian or a child playing on the sidewalk and respond accordingly. The ordinance that we have now requires a triangular area for clear vision that extends in the residential areas 30 feet back from the intersection of the property lines at the corner. So it is in this graphic, it is the red triangle here. We are taking a look at this ordinance because we think maybe we could be a little more flexible about how we apply the clear vision ordinance and still provide the same protection. And so we are considering whether or not in the gold version here, whether we could, instead of using the property lines to draw the triangle, actually use the curb line or the edge of pavement where there is no curb. And that way we bump it out further where the driver would be looking as opposed to back here. Nobody is stopping back here. They're pulling up to the stop line at a controlled intersection. Where it is not a controlled intersection, then yes, maybe we need to have more advanced visibility so that they don't have to come to a complete stop before they can actually see what's coming at them. In my memo to you, I kind of equivocated about the actual ordinance, and it does require some editing. It was sort of a rough first draft, and we haven't put a lot of work into it. Since then, we have been talking about using AASHTO standards, which are adopted standards by, and I can't tell you what AASHTO stands for, but it's a transportation organization at any rate. But those are very complex about how much visibility area you need as you approach an intersection based on not only whether it's a controlled, meaning stop sign or stop light, but also on the speed that the traffic is going and the different types of streets, whether it's a local street or a arterial street. So anyway, this is something that's a work in progress, but there are a couple points that we thought maybe you could weigh in on and give us some direction. This is the ordinance as it reads now. One of the things that I've highlighted here at the bottom of the clear vision requirement is that it does make the exception that trees are allowed in this clear vision triangle if all the branches and foliage are limbed up to a height of 8 feet above the curb. But I do have a photo here where you can see, well, here are a couple photos. This and we also wanted to add in, what if our topography blocks the view anyway? Is someone then allowed to put something on top of the hill that comes right up to the intersection? We have a couple examples where topography is sort of in the way of visibility. This is a retaining wall that you can see better in this picture. And here is the example of the tree. And trees can be pretty large and block a certain amount of visibility. On the other hand, we certainly don't want to recommend that all the mature trees at the corners have to be taken down, but we could discourage a planting in the visibility triangle, especially if it gets smaller and it really is closer to the actual intersection of the streets. Another issue that we want to address in the new ordinance is whether or not any fences would be allowed, even if they are, such as this one, at least 75% open. So there is quite a bit of visibility through this fence. Right now we say, fences, no fences. And But we do allow the trees. So there's kind of a inconsistency a little bit. So do any of you have any suggestions, ideas about this ordinance?
Well, I'm curious about, so let's say we have we have a intersection now. Somebody's vision seen around that corner?
Well, the draft is written that development lots need to have a clear vision triangle. So, you know, it was targeted at new construction, I guess, or new fencing or whatever. But I think it's also important that our ordinance states that these clear visibility triangles have to be maintained.
Somebody that, as I can think of one intersection that is just dead.
Okay.
Southwest Fleet, and I'm going to say it's...
Seventh. A Seventh and Fleet is definitely one. But there are several up in that neighborhood.
By the time you get those out onto Fleet, you're halfway out in the middle of Fleet before you can make your turn to see if he's coming. But would somebody like that have to remove that? I mean, I think...
What do you think? I mean, what would you suggest?
Well, it's a burden on the property owner.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
It's extreme.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a dangerous intersection, on the other hand. I think something should be in the ordinance that says that the property sells. This is something that has to be taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
Compliance.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the condition of sale. But we need to be conformity with the existing properties as well as with the new properties.
Okay. One thing about this change in the ordinance, it would actually make that clear visibility triangle smaller, probably in most cases. So hopefully we wouldn't have as many we wouldn't be making more non-conforming situations by adapting this ordinance. So that's a possibility. We do not now allow, as I said, fencing or buildings to encroach in this. I should mention, in the commercial zones, we have a 15-foot rather than a 30-foot triangle. And there are some corners, even on Highway 101, where we have buildings that are right up to the property line. And we do encourage that because we want to get the feeling of an enclosed street and this intensity of use. So in those cases, we have to, I guess, accept the fact that people have to stop, have to be careful, have to inch their way out to see what's going on. Or maybe those are at intersections where there might be a traffic light, so they know when they're supposed to go. They don't have to look to see if somebody's going to hit them when they nose out into the lane. So it is a complex sort of issue.
Well, I could see on this intersection, if you put a mirror up across the street, that, you know, you definitely have an idea if somebody is coming or not.
Okay.
That might be a way
that
to
might be a
those situations. You'll see them in a lot of cities where they have blind corners and there's people pulling out of driveways, where you'll have a round mirror up so you can see around the corner.
Right. I think that'll be good for pedestrians as well to see what's happening. One thing along those lines is that we do have this transportation and growth management grant that we received about a year ago, and we're finally getting the intergovernmental agreement signed and can start working with our consultant. I have a memo going to the council asking for approval of that agreement on Monday, and I think the whole project will get started shortly after. I'm hoping that they might give us some input into what's reasonable and what would be safe for pedestrians and cyclists as well as cars at intersections. So maybe we're jumping the gun a little bit on this because we might get some good advice as we work through that process. and get some other ideas on how we can deal with safety.
Are you talking about changing just for residential or for both?
I believe the ordinance, and I'll have to check, but I believe the ordinance addresses both. Right now, the ordinance is very brief, and but in our clear vision, and so we did not track it when we made changes. But the it says here it is: stop controlled intersections. The leg along the street subject to traffic control device shall extend back 15 feet from the start of the intersection. Well, that's a traffic control. It doesn't talk about commercial. I'm sure I saw that in here.
Yeah, it's on. Well, I don't know what page, but it's under section B3B.
3B, yes. Okay. Well, that's just what I read. Okay.
And maybe because I'm not understanding it completely, I'm not sure that I see a need for a difference between residential and residential.
Okay.
And that if you could, whatever you ultimately come up with, it will apply to each. That might be a little bit easier for people to understand. Or
I think maybe what I'm thinking of, the distinction is in the old ordinance instead of the new one. Yep, here it is right here. This is the old ordinance. And it talks about residential zone being 30 feet and in all other zones 15. Yeah. So it looks like we're getting rid of that, and instead we are making a distinction based on the traffic control,
okay,
which makes more sense.
I think so.
The other thing that is not in the draft but probably should be is an acknowledgement that ODOT has control over Highway 101 intersections to a certain extent. And I did get an email from John Dittar, the ODOT planner, who said, can you please make sure that that's reflected in here, you know, what our authority is. So we would want to add that in.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. All right. Ordinance number 3. Commercial design standards. Now, we do not have to get into the design standards themselves for the most part here. We're not talking about changes about building design or site design. So most of these are grammatical changes, organizational changes, and also I've suggested that we need definitions. We talk about pearl areas and string areas, and yet, but we don't have them defined. So I am suggesting that we put in a definition of the pearl district, and this is language that's been used elsewhere to describe what the pearls are. And, in fact, I think it's in the code, but it's just not in the definitions. So I think you all probably are familiar with the pearls and the string approach to the highway and the, okay, the six communities that were joined to form Lincoln City still retain a certain identity, and they have standards in place in our zoning code, and sometimes organizations that help promote that distinctive character. And so those are called the pearls that are joined together by our string, which is Highway 101 specifically, but also the rest of the area in between. So we have Wekoma, we have Ocean Lake, DeLake, Nelscott, Taft, and Cutler City. So one thing that was not clear in the original wording in the commercial design standards was what was a string. And we have been applying it as if everything that isn't a pearl is a string, and so I have put in a definition that says that. For instance, Bi-Mart is located off the highway, the new store, and we applied the design standards to Bi-Mart. And any other application that comes in that's off the highway, Okay.
Just a friendly suggestion.
Yes.
In your second line up there where you're delineating and you're putting in example, Wacoma, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
It might be clearer just to forget the example and put all six of them in there.
Okay. That's a good idea.
And I don't know. I don't think that this is the place to do it, but I know for me, and I would assume for other people, that it is very difficult conceptually to know where a pearl ends and a string begins. And, you know, somehow, I don't think this is the place to do it, but somehow, even if I'm driving down the street, I have a sense for where it does, mm-hmm. but I don't really know where, you know, Ocean Lake officially begins coming south and where it officially ends and where D Lake begins. I mean, is there a string between Ocean Lake and D Lake? I don't know.
No, actually, those are adjacent, and those all are shown on our zoning map with a dark line around the perimeter.
Urban Renewal put some signs.
They do have signs, and maybe you've seen these.
Yeah, I've seen. Yeah.
They have sometimes. I think they have all.
They have all six. And they've got it highlighted.
And then they have one highlighted so that you know. I don't know if they're exactly at the transitional point where you're entering it, or whether it's, you know, they had to pick a place that was available.
Mm-hmm.
So, are you suggesting that we want to have that more clear when you're out on the street, or when we designate them in the code?
I think both. I mean, yeah. I mean, clearly you're going to tell the commissioners or whoever they are, but I think it would be, you know, informative to the general public.
Okay. The ocean.
Maybe I'm the minority here.
No, I live in D Lake. I think. I live on Northeast 11th Street, and Ocean Lake and D Lake, I mean, I'm right there.
Right there.
And I don't know where one starts and one begins. And a developer coming in or somebody wanting to do something, you know, I mean, they can come in and find out from you guys whether they're in a pearl or a string or
yes.
where they're at. But it'd be nice if there was some definition of exactly.
Well, when they come to the planning department, we can tell them exactly which one they're in. The other ones are separated by greater distance, like mm-hmm. Wacoma and Ocean Lake and
right.
DeLake and Nelscott, you know, a much bigger stretch in between. So that's not so much of a problem there. But I will call that out in here, and I might also say as designated. Oh, I do say. Means an area on the zoning map that's designated, mm-hmm. and we do have those designations on the zoning map.
Well, then maybe every time we have a new commissioner that they would get that as part of their orientation packet.
When we have the hearing, I'll make sure I bring a map that shows.
Okay.
That
would be good. Yeah.
And the other thing I might mention about these commercial design standards, they apply to pearls that have not developed their own standards. The Taft Village Core has its own standards that take the place of these, and same with Ocean Lake.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Okay. Anybody else?
Thanks.
Okay. There are a few more things here, and I just, I have tweaked the language in several places, and you can see little red marks where cross-outs and new language have been inserted. But I wanted to show you, for instance, this section under applicability, because it looks like it's a really big change. But in fact, what's happened here is that I think probably left over from a previous version of the ordinance, and once they changed the organization, they didn't go back and take this out. But this section is referring to sections further down in the chapter, but they're making the wrong connection, so I took it out. I didn't think it was necessary. Let's see. In this case, we are talking about site development standards, and I pulled out a section that was actually put in building design as opposed to site design because it was in the wrong place, essentially. I moved it up here. So, again, it's not new language that I'm proposing. It's in the code. It just was in the wrong place. There are a couple things that I did that were different. This one, for instance, for some reason in our code right now, it says that we want in PEARLS a minimum height of 18 feet. And we ran into this with the coffee kiosks, and they actually put parapets on them so that they would give a more impressive, I guess, look in the PEARLS. And for some reason in this section, it calls out single-story structures that are taking the place. They allow single-story structures of less than 18 feet if they are replacing an auto-oriented use. And I could not think why the code would make that distinction. For instance, if a gas station had been vacated and was sitting there, but somebody came in and wanted to do some other kind of business in there, they would be allowed to have a building less than 18 feet. Now, perhaps if it's it was to help reuse that building, but I'm not sure, and I'm just kind of wondering what your feelings are about that. We like reuse. Maybe that's the reason why we're willing to forego the 18-foot minimum.
Would that be because an existing gas station and did something else that would trigger a reuse of that building and the new codes would kick in? Is that...
Well, that's if it's certainly if it's a substantial improvement to the place. And I was thinking that's what originally came to my mind. It's sort of like, why would we allow the replacement? Maybe what I need to do is reword this so that if they are building maybe approved single-story structures. But this implies to me that we're talking about a new structure, and that's why I thought, why are we making this distinction? But maybe yes, if we want to make sure that I will check to see whether reuse would actually, you know, be allowed anyway, and I think it probably would. But I want to know your reaction to whether or not, do we have any reason to allow a new structure to be less than the minimum?
Come into our...
Okay.
Give a PEARL.
Right.
So.
Okay.
That's
a curious exception, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm curious.
Maybe it was intended for reuse of an existing structure, but it doesn't sound that way.
Yeah.
So it's either, yeah, it's just not clear. Okay, we'll fix it. And this is a real change. The lighting part of the standards talks about lumens, the number of lumens or the brightness of lighting in the outdoors. And we talk about having a maximum luminance not to exceed 4-foot candles. And it's been pointed out to us that this is very low. And I did look at Eugene's ordinance, and they require that the average luminance of parking lots not be over 4. So I have a feeling that maybe this was sort of a bad typo. And I know we don't need excessive lighting in parking lots, but it seems to me that the maximum of 4 is, in fact, too low. In fact, some ordinances require a minimum of 4. So.
Well, what is, to put it into something that I can understand, maybe everybody else knows, but how bright are 3-foot candles versus 4-foot candles versus a 100-watt light bulb? I mean, what
That's tough.
Yeah.
We do not have a meter, and maybe we need to get one so that we can go out and see some examples, and we could maybe do this before the public hearing so that you can actually go to places and say, okay, I'm standing in 4-foot candles of light as opposed to 16. This graphic here is the photometric plan, or part of it, from the Bi-Mart parking lot. And you can see that they have a maximum of 16.9, which would be right under the light standards. And then it drops off significantly as you move away from being right underneath the lamp. So their average is 3.11. And so we may want to go, I mean, if this is what we assume is reasonable, then, you know, we'd maybe want to go a little bit above 3. But as I was saying, you know, obviously the ordinance is concerned about excessive lighting and trying to, and it's you know, sustainable to have only the light you need and focus downward. Some people feel that a lot of lighting creates a safer environment, but in fact, times it can just cause more glare and actually make it harder to see if someone or some, you know, something's in the parking lot. So I'm still grappling with what is exactly the best number. The standards do allow for some variation if approved by the planning director, and so the planning director has some latitude if something seems unreasonable to vary it based on, you know, evidence or particular circumstances. So in this case, we allowed, after going back and forth with Bi-Mart a number of times, we allowed this with the average of 3.11. And it also... our standards also require that the luminance be zero at a certain number of feet outside the property line so that you don't get a lot of light trespass. And so those two things are quite important. And I have to admit, I don't have a really good feel either, Eric, about the, you know, how much light...
What it is.
How we feel about 16 lumens rather than 4.
Well, maybe...
So I basically just looked at other ordinances.
Yeah, if you had a light meter and you could go around some existing parking lots and require some midnight surveillance, I guess.
Right.
And go up to Bi-Mart or Safeway and even, you know, down below here at Price and Pride, and how bright parking lots are.
Okay, and we can...
Something that we can compare to.
Right, and we can let you know in advance so that you can go out and do a little research yourself before the hearing. I think that's a great idea.
Thank you.
I just got a question, a curiosity question. But is there anywhere that the lights must be maintained? Sunrise comes up. Is there anything in the ordinance that specifies parking lot light?
Oh, are you thinking of examples where they're staying on too long during into the day?
Or if they come, you know, I mean, it's light out till 10 o'clock at night. Parking lights, is there anywhere in the ordinance that the parking lights are 7 o'clock, staying full day?
I can't think of anything. Do you know, Kate? I don't know of anything. Are you suggesting that maybe we should have something that...
You know, I'm just interested in...
Right.
I see a lot of light that's, you know, going to waste as power, and it pretty well at 9 o'clock during the summertime. It's on.
Good point. I would think it would be certainly an advantage to the property owner also to have...
And I don't want to ordinance and rules and regulate everybody too. But.
And I don't know what kind of mechanism actually controls that and whether everyone would have that on their lighting.
and require maybe to have sensors.
Mm-hmm.
That can be building.
For new lighting, or for, are you thinking about any? Okay.
Did Bimar want a higher average or a lower average?
Oh, well, see, the maximum in our ordinance right now is 4, and they wanted and ended up with 16 for maximum. And the reasons they gave were that, well, they were reusing poles that are already, remember, this is the parking lot that was overflow for the Tanger Outlet Mall.
Right.
And they purchased the parking lot from them. So they wanted to use lights that were already wired and in certain locations, and then they're adding new lighting. But especially in those, they, in order to, well, okay, so they, in order to have at least a minimum amount of lighting in all corners of the parking lot, they have to have more at the pole.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if that helps much, but anyway, we had a lot of discussion about that, and their lighting designer was saying, "This is ridiculous. I've never seen a standard this low." And so that's when I started looking around and looking at Eugene and other codes.
Okay. Anybody else?
Okay, and there may be more here. Let's see. No, I think this is the last one, actually. Okay, that's all I have for those first three ordinances.
And then we have open space and park rezoning.
Kate's going to do that one.
Oh, okay.
She has a PowerPoint as well.
Okay.
Okay, this is mostly maps and a little bit of photos. And we see this as a fairly simple project, mostly to give us a better visual idea of what throughout the city is really park and open space versus single family, multifamily, other types of land use designations. I did bring a map that I put over on the wall, if you want to look at that after the meeting. That's also in our office, and that map is also posted on the website with the rest of the draft ordinances. We'll just show you bits and pieces of the city as we go through it on this PowerPoint. So we're going to start at the north end of town, and this includes a piece of property that's about 60 acres or so. And it's just north of the villages at Cascade Head, and is proposed to be zoned as open space, and currently is R17.5, which is what everything else on the north end of town is. Then this is the covers mainly the Wacoma and Ocean Lake areas, and this covers some park area and some open space. We have, starting at the north, we have the Holmes Road boat ramp, and the park itself is already zoned park, but the parking lot is not. It has retained an R17.5 zoning, and we're proposing to zone that park. And then going over to the Dorchester, just behind the Dorchester House in Northwest, we have the tennis courts, and I think there might be picnic tables. And it has retained a general commercial zoning, and I'm not really sure what the reason is for that, but we're proposing that it also be zoned park to reflect its actual use. Then we have the, there is a piece of property about 4 acres over on the west side of Northeast West Devils Lake Road that was acquired last year, or perhaps early this year. It's currently zoned professional campus. I believe it has some wetland on it, but it was acquired as open space with open space funds. So we're proposing to zone that open space. Then, just north of Kurtz's Park, there were several properties that were acquired either last year or the year before, and one of them we already rezoned to open space. If you're seeing what I'm pointing at there, yeah. We zoned it to open space when we did the rezoning of all of the R1 county lands, because that piece was already zoned R1, or it was an R1 county designation, and we rezoned it to open space. But just west of it, there is another piece that has a zoning designation of RM, but we are proposing that it be zoned for open space. And the remainder of that acquisition is not being proposed to be rezoned at this time. There may be some other uses being considered. Then also on this same map, we have the skateboard park itself, which is just adjacent to Kurtzis Park and has a current designation of R17.5 and is proposed to be zoned park. And here's a lovely picture of the Holmes Road Park on a nice day. And then the Dorchester Park with the tennis courts. And the skate park. So our next area is generally the D Lake area. And within this slide, we have a property that's not owned by the city. Most of these are owned by the city, but just a few are not. The Devil's Lake State Park is, of course, owned by the state of Oregon and is currently zoned R110 and is proposed to be zoned park. And we have spoken with representatives from state parks, and they have no concerns with that. They also own this little piece that is already zoned park, this green little green square here. Then adjacent to that piece that's owned by the state is a piece that's owned by the city on Southeast 1st Street, and that is currently zoned recreation commercial, but is proposed to be zoned open space, as I believe it was acquired with open space funds. The remainder of that property fronts on Highway 101 and is not proposed to be changed. And this is just a little slide. If you haven't been in the state park recently, this is taken back in March, so it was before it was finished. But this is a slide of one of the new restrooms that was constructed at the park. You might remember seeing the variance before you for the floodplain variance. And this is just the D River Open Space Southeast 1st sign. So most of these pictures are actually just lifted directly from the city's website. We didn't go out and take any detailed pictures yet, but we may have some more for the public hearing. Okay, so the next area is what I named South D Lake and the Agnes Creek area. The Agnes Creek Open Space Corridor begins down by Canyon Drive Park and then continues south for quite a ways south of Bard Road. Most of it is already zoned open space, as you can tell by this medium green color. It has a couple of intervening properties that I don't believe are currently owned by the city that have retained an R110 designation. They're not part of this project, but on the northern end of the Agnes Creek Corridor, there are several parcels that have been either acquired. There's three separate pieces that have been acquired within the last couple of years, and then one of those is also the Gardner property, that is the privately owned land that's being proposed to be designated residential rather than retain an open space zoning. There was a property trade I'll show you in the next slide. The south part of the Agnes Creek Corridor on the south side of Bard Road includes a piece of property that's, I think it's maybe a couple of acres, and has an RM designation but is being proposed to be designated open space. This was the area you may have heard recently will be the subject of a demonstration harvest project, a tree thinning project. And this is just at part of the Agnes Creek Corridor as seen from Southwest Coast. So here is kind of a closer up view of the Gardner property and the city's property that was traded. The whole idea was to make better connectivity in that Agnes Creek Corridor. So the Gardner property used to go this far back, but this portion was obtained by the city, and then this sort of aqua-colored piece was part of the city's property and is now part of the gardener's property. The gardener property in total starts at whatever this street is. I think it might be Dune Avenue, and then it goes roughly how I'm outlining it there. Most of it is zoned R15 already. This main western part of it is already zoned R15, and then the balance of it is zoned R110, except for the part that used to be owned by the city, which is still zoned open space. So the proposal is to rezone the gardener parcel of about, I think it's 1.3 acres, completely zone it R15, and then rezone the portion that was acquired by the city, which is currently zoned R110, to open space. So the next area is up down by the high school and the community college, and this is quite a lot of acreage. The first part of it, the western part, surrounds the community college land. This little strip of yellow in the middle is where it is owned by the community college and is not part of this project, but it's surrounded on both sides by land that was acquired by the city from Oregon Coast Community College. And so it's proposed to be rezoned to open space, and it's currently R17.5. Then there's quite a large area owned by the city to the east of the Ridge Apartments, essentially, and then north of the Bayview subdivision. It's about 70-plus acres proposed to be zoned open space. There's a picture of a piece of the spyglass open space. Then the last part is down in the Taft and Cutler City area. The first parcel is owned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and that's part of the Siletz Wildlife Refuge area. They also own this parcel to the north that's bisected by Southeast 54th Drive. And for no reason, it was left off of this map. I think it was more of an oversight than anything. And I have spoken with the biologist representing the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they have no concerns about rezoning this to open space as well as this other parcel. So we may, in the final go, when we bring this back for the hearing, we may also include this piece to the north. And it's all currently zoned R17.5. Then there is a parcel down in Cutler City that is signed and functions as the city's Cutler open space. It does appear that the city owns it, and we have improved it and we maintain it, but it is owned by Lincoln County, and they own it through a tax foreclosure and have for many years. But in the late 90s, they granted an easement to the city to improve it and operate it, and so we do. Except for this piece here that I'm outlining, which is part of this northern tax lot and part of the southern tax lot. That's mostly all significant wetland, and back in the 90s, it was going to be acquired by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and so it was just left out of the part that had the city's easement on it. For whatever reason, that never went through, and it may yet go through someday, but there's no proposed development on it. And the representative from Fish and Wildlife said if we wanted to propose to rezone that to open space, that would be okay with them. And so I'm still coordinating with the county representatives to see if they have any concerns about, you know, why we should not rezone it. And if they do, that's certainly something we want to consider. But we don't, you know, so that one may also be included in the final go. But the part that is already covered by the easement will be proposed for open space. Then just south of that is about 1.85 acres that's owned by the city that was donated to the city when there was a planned unit development approved in the south end of town. It was a small PUD called Winged Sanctuary, and it was approved. You're nodding, you recall. I think in 2003, 2004, something like that. But anyway, it's owned by the city, zoned R17.5, and proposed to be open space. And the last piece in Cutler City area is 250 by 100 lots that are a park called the Kids and Senior Park, and has some play equipment on it, and has retained an R15 zoning, but we're proposing to zone that as park. So we just have a couple more pictures here. There's the Cutler City Kids Park, the entrance to the Cutler Open Space, and then these are just the dates for the hearings. So if you have any questions, or we're not really looking for any necessarily any direction, we just wanted to give you kind of a good overview of where we're talking about and try to explain it a little in advance, and we'll probably have a little more detail, more photos at the hearing in August.
It's mainly just some housekeeping.
Yeah, you know, we certainly don't see this as anything controversial. We just really think when lands have, there was a rezoning. Well, just to back up a little bit, in 1998 there was a bond measure passed, or anyway, the voters allowed the city to purchase open space. And so a lot of open space was purchased, but there was no zone called open space. So in 2002, the city council did approve the zone that we now call open space. And in 2004, about 140 acres of what had been acquired already was rezoned. Well, since that time, we've bought a lot more. This total project comes to about a little over 200 acres. It might be about 230 acres. But that also includes the state park and the fish and wildlife. It's not all city acquisitions for open space. It's other people's property, too, or other agencies' properties as well. So, yeah, it is sort of that. It is a housekeeping measure, we think, to more accurately reflect what the use of these lands are.
Anybody else? Okay, thanks, Kate. Appreciate it. Okay, that ends the work sessions on the proposed ordinance amendments. The next item is a training video, and I think we had discussion before the actually start of the meeting that in honor of Eric's birthday, we are going to dispense with the training video, and Deborah has said that she will look into making copies for all the commissioners to look at in our leisure. So,
and can we mention that it's also being shown on Channel 4 occasionally?
Yeah. It's on Channel 4, which is the local access channel, at least through Charter, and at intermittent times.
I believe the schedule is on our webpage.
And okay, so if you're interested in that, Deborah, why don't you just go ahead and elaborate for the audience what it is?
Oh, okay. This is called Living on the Edge, and it is about coastal erosion. Since we have been talking about changing our geologic hazard setback, and also acknowledging the new information that we got from our coastal management program that was prepared in a study by Jonathan Allen and George Priest in 2004 that is exactly about this topic. I think this would be useful to watch in advance of the public hearing on the 2nd of August.
Okay. Anybody comment on that? Okay. reports and comments. Anything from the community development director in absentia?
Yes, I don't believe so.
City attorney is also absent this evening. Planning commissioners, anybody? Anything?
Happy birthday, Eric.
Yeah. Thank you.
There is no public, so we'll assume there will be no public comments. Brings us to our next meeting. 2 weeks from tonight, right? Yeah.
Yes.
2 weeks from tonight. Okay.
And we will have four hearings that night, and those will be on the ordinances that we discussed at our last meeting, the attached single family in the R1 zone, A-frame signs and non-conforming signs, public notice requirements, and geologic setback and coastal erosion.
Okay. Anybody else?
Nope. Thank you very much.
All right. The meeting is adjourned.